At the age of 75, Abram was called by God out of Ur of the Chaldeans. He was called to go to a place that he did not know, to leave familiar surroundings, a cultured city, a close-knit family. He was called to leave all that was familiar to him, to follow the word of a God that he did not know. He was a heathen. He was, as far as we know, a completely, well, not a godless man, for the people of the area were advanced in religion, but not in the worship of the God of creation. Not in the worship of the God of the Bible as we know him. But God came and encountered Abram and called him. And then we have this amazing story of Abram leaving, listening to that call, and following God and going on that journey to a land he didn't know, and leaving everything behind, though his nephew accompanied him for at least part of the time. Abram was given promises of a land, promises of a heritage, promises of a son. And he believed God and those promises. And so Abram has come to us from the very beginning of the story of his life as a man of faith. The man who believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness. Now, as we've observed in our studies in the book of Genesis, Abram's faith was not always consistent. Abram's faith was not always this strong, believing, enduring faith by which he has become famous. We've seen him stumble and fall along the way. We've observed him journey into Egypt in order to avoid a famine in Canaan, and there to present his wife as his sister in order to divert any danger from his own life. We've seen him do it not once, but twice. We've seen his faithlessness as well as his faithfulness. But the thing that marks out the life of Abraham for us is his belief in God. His belief in the promises of God. By the time we get to the 21st chapter, 25 years have passed since that day when Abraham first encountered God. Since that day when he first heard the promises of God, of a land. He's seen the land by now. He's lived in the land, in a tent, admittedly, wandering from one part of it to another, on occasion exiting it and coming back into it. But nevertheless, he has walked through the land of promise. He knows the land that is to be given to him. He's done all of that, and he's seen God's faithfulness. This wasn't an empty promise, it was real, it was grounded in reality. He was promised a son, and this has been a little bit more tricky for Abraham, and for his wife, for that matter. He was to be a nation, but with no offspring, how could this be? The laws of the lands in those days allowed for an offspring to be derived through a servant girl, a slave girl. And so Sarah had suggested to Abraham that perhaps this was God's way, God's means of providing him with an heir and so he had taken Hagar, and by her had fathered a son, Ishmael. Well, some 14 years have passed since that time, and new revelation has been given to Abraham along the way. Indeed, it was a number of years that passed when Abraham was still convinced that Ishmael was the son of promise, was the means by which God would make of him a great nation. It wasn't until a year before the events recorded to us in the 21st chapter that Abraham is given definite grounds to believe that his own wife, Sarah, was to be the mother of the promised son. That Ishmael was not the promised son. A promise was given. A promise was made. An unbelievable promise, so that Sarah, sitting in her tent overhearing the Lord speaking to Abraham, laughed. How ridiculous was it that a woman of her age should bear a child? But the Lord visited Sarah as he had said. And the Lord did to Sarah as he had promised. And Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, at the time which God had spoken to him. God, you see, is in control. God has his plans. God has his purposes. And they cannot be second-guessed by man. Abraham tried. He failed. But God's plans and God's purposes stand. God's plans and God's purposes are always accomplished at his time, in his way. Abraham has learned over the years to believe that, to trust that, and to put his faith in this God. And so, the true son of promise is born. And it gives Sarah cause to laugh again. She says, God has made laughter for me. No longer the laugh of unbelief, incredulity. Now it's the genuine laughter of sheer pleasure. That she, at 90 years of age, holds her own baby in her arms. 25 years have passed since the promise was first given. And here, at last, is the son. There is other laughter, though. She predicts that everyone who hears of what has happened will laugh. They will, in a sense, be not joining her in her joy, but having this laughter of unbelief that she had. An incredulous laughter that 90-year-old Sarah has a son. You must be joking, is the kind of idea that is being conveyed here. Indeed, both of these terms are drawn out from the name of Isaac himself, which means he laughs. It's a central motif in this story. The laughter and the changing laughter, the incredulity, the belief, the thankfulness, the hope, the confidence. All of this wrapped up in the name of this baby boy lying in the arms of Sarah, who indeed would have said that Abram's wife would nurse a child. But God is faithful. God's promises come true. He is not bound by the limitations of our existence. But when he says, he does. What he promises, he gives. And let us never doubt that at all in our own lives then. When he calls upon us to follow him, when he tells us, take up your cross in whatever situation you might be in, whatever hardship you may have to endure, for loyalty to me, allegiance to me, be sure that it will bring blessing to you. We don't need to doubt that. We don't need to wonder at it. But neither should we second guess how it is that God is going to accomplish that. He is faithful, and he will do it. Well, this birth of this son of promise is given so matter-of-factly here in this story, isn't it? And of course, we've been expecting it for a long time. We know the story. We've read it hundreds of times since our childhood. There's nothing new here. And of course, we're also familiar with the next episode as it unfolds from verse 8. This child of promise grew and was weaned. So we're reckoning on round about 3 years passing in this time. And Abraham made a great feast on that day. You see, for an infant child to survive through the years of nursing until they're weaned round about the age of 3, was quite something in those days. We are thankfully spared the anguish of the loss of a child at a young age, as was so common in the past. Yes, there are those who are called to bear that cross and to endure that sorrow. But it's not the thing that we're familiar with. A couple of weeks ago, our brother Jim Renihan was talking about the Puritans, 16th and 17th centuries, life expectancy in London. If you survived to your 20th birthday, likelihood is you'd live a relatively long life, perhaps even to your 50s. But most died before they got to 20. We don't know that, do we? It's so alien to us. Well, now, that helps you perhaps to understand why it is that on this day Abraham makes a great feast. It's a celebration, you see, that here is a child that has survived through some crucial months and years. And so they celebrate the weaning of the baby. But as some are celebrating, we're told that Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, laughing. And the sense of this is he is laughing in a negative way. It's not a positive joining in the celebrations of the day. But he is mocking, he is ridiculing. But furthermore, the intent is that he is ridiculing Isaac. Here he is, he's 17 years old now, Ishmael. And here's a 3-year-old, and Sarah observes Ishmael taunting him. That's the sense here. And so we recognize now, we understand her response to this situation. She goes to Abraham and she says, cast out the slave woman with her son. The son of the slave woman shall not be heir with my son Isaac. Well, it's hard, the hard thing for Abraham. Ishmael, for years, was in his mind the son of promise. He's had 12 months or so to get by this time, 4 years to get used to the idea that Ishmael is not the son of promise, but nevertheless, he is dear to him. He is his own firstborn. And he wasn't pleased with this suggestion that he be cast away. But God comes, God intervenes in this situation, not entirely supporting Sarah and her rationale for ridding herself of the slave woman and her son, but God says, yes, do what Sarah says, because God has his own purposes. God has his own basis for the son and the slave woman to be cast off. Isaac is the promised child. Isaac is the one. In a sense, God is saying to Abraham, understand this. Get this into your head, Abraham. It isn't Ishmael. It's Isaac. It's Isaac. He is the one I promised. Not Ishmael. It's Isaac. Embrace Isaac. Hold on to Isaac. Don't hold on to Ishmael. And God, Abraham listens, and Abraham provides what, under the circumstances, is a fairly meager ration, and sends Hagar and her son off into the wilderness. It is likely, I think, that Hagar intended to head home to Egypt. But she got lost and wandered in this wilderness until the water in the bottle, the skin that Abraham had given her, ran dry. She hasn't actually gone very far. But there she is in distress in the midst of this wilderness. We need to remember that Ishmael is 17 years of age now. We get the impression, don't we, as we read this story, that she's carrying a little baby around with her. And as the water runs out, she puts this little baby under a bush while she goes off 100 meters or so and cries there. No, Ishmael's a teenager. Ishmael's 17 years of age, but obviously he's succumbed under the heat of the day, under the journey that they've made, and there he is lying under a bush in the desert, while his mother averts her eyes from the inevitable as she sees it. But God comes. God has come to her before. She's seen God, met God before, and here he comes and speaks to her through an angel and encourages her, promises her that, as he has promised before, the boy will become a great nation in his own right. He's going to survive this ordeal. He's going to make it through by the grace of God. And as she looks up, she sees what she hadn't seen before. It isn't suddenly that miraculously a well appears there, but she hadn't noticed it in her distress. God opens her eyes and she sees the well of water. She goes, fills the skin, gives the boy a drink, and the rest is history, as we say. They live, they grow, he marries. He's an expert with the bow. And there he is in the wilderness of Paran. Two sons of Abraham. What contrasting lives they present to us. One, the son of a slave woman, cast off and wandering. The other, the long hoped for son of promise, the son of Abram's wife, there safe, his life being celebrated, while the other is cast off. Such a contrast. Notice, though, that this son of the bondwoman still receives promises. He, like Isaac, will become a great nation. He is, like Isaac, the descendant of Abraham, and in some senses is blessed because of that. But while Isaac has all the promises and blessings of the covenant that God has made with Abraham, Ishmael has none of those. He will be a nation, but not a nation near to God. He will become great, but not great in God's eyes. And this, I think, we need to bear in mind as we seek to understand God's purpose in recounting for us this episode and this story. You know, I guess in a sense we could say the birth of Isaac in verses 1 through 7 is all that was needed, and we could just carry on then with the rest of the story, and as happens with so many characters in the Bible, Ishmael just sort of drifts out of the picture and never heard of again. But that's not the case. And if we're to rightly understand this passage, we need, unsurprisingly, I think, to turn to the New Testament. And specifically to turn to Paul's letter to the church in Galatia, the book of Galatians. For here he presents us with the purpose of God for us in recounting this story. Let me read to you from the fourth chapter of Galatians, beginning at the 21st verse. He says, to a church that is grappling with claims that in order to be true followers of God, they must pursue the religious rites of the Israelites that were given under the law of Moses. Trust Christ and obey the law, in effect, is what they were being told. And Abram says, tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not listen to the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by a slave woman and one by a free woman. But the son of the slave was born according to the flesh, while the son of the free woman was born through promise. Now this may be interpreted allegorically. The sense of the Greek here is more definite than that. It's not that Paul is taking this story and using it as an illustration. The sense is that this story has been given in order to present this truth. It has a purpose to present this truth. It's not just that Abram thinks to him, how can I illustrate what I'm trying to convey to these people in Galatia? Oh yes, I know. I'll take the story of Hagar and Sarah, of Ishmael and Isaac, and I'll use that to illustrate my point. No, the sense here is that Paul is using the purpose for which the story was given. He's unfolding for these Christians in Galatia a truth that is represented in the lives of these women and their sons. He says, this may be interpreted allegorically. These women are two covenants. One is from Mount Sinai, bearing children for slavery. She is Hagar. Now Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. She corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, and she is our mother, For it is written, Rejoice, O barren one who does not bear, break forth and cry aloud, you who are not in labour, for the children of the desolate one will be more than those of the one who has a husband. Now, you brothers, like Isaac, are children of promise. But just as at the time he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit, so also it is now. But what does the Scripture say? Cast out the slave woman and her son, for the son of the slave woman shall not inherit with the son of the free woman. So, brothers, we are not children of the slave, but of the free. What is Paul seeking to do? What is this contrast between Sarah and Hagar, Isaac and Ishmael, teaching us? Well, as Paul unfolds it for us here in these verses, it presents us with two covenants, two ways of relating to the living God. One is presented in terms of Hagar and Ishmael, the slave woman and her son born into slavery. She is likened to the covenant that was made at Mount Sinai. A covenant governed by law. A covenant governed by a requirement to obey legal demands. If you obey, you will live. Now, it's not just an interesting extra that Paul puts in by making the comment that Mount Sinai is in Arabia. He does it for a very clear reason. He is pointing out that Mount Sinai is not in the Promised Land. And that those who seek to relate to God on the basis of the law are not recipients of the promise. They never get to the Promised Land. They cannot get to the Promised Land. On the other hand, Sarah is presented not as Mount Sinai, but as Jerusalem. And not the Jerusalem of Paul's day, for that is likened to Mount Sinai. What Paul is saying is that the people of Jerusalem of his age were just like those who are under the law, seeking to obey the law, to keep the law in order to be right with God. Now, of course, Jerusalem is in the Promised Land, physically. But he's relating this to spiritual realities. And he's saying, these people of Jerusalem, who seek to relate to God on the basis of the law, they're in Arabia. They're not living in the Promised Land. They're not recipients of the promises. On the other hand, there is a spiritual Jerusalem, a Jerusalem which is above. Now, we need to remember that in the book of Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews points out that even Abraham himself understood that the promises related far more than to just a physical region that is known as Palestine now. He understood that there was a spiritual dimension to those promises. He was longing for a city, a spiritual city that was to come. And here it is used in Paul's language to describe those who are children of the free woman, children of the promise, like Isaac. That they are ones who who are born not in a purely natural way. That's how Ishmael was born. Abraham, Hagar, get together, have a baby. Okay? Entirely natural, entirely normal, entirely what we would expect. Abraham and Sarah get together and have a baby. But the point is, it's not what we expect. He's 100, she's 90. We don't expect it. She has been barren all her life, and now she is not only barren, she is past the age of childbearing. It is not what we expect. You see, the point that is being made is that this is a miracle. God visited. God came at an appointed time. He came according to promise. And it is because of God's intervention in their lives that Isaac is born. Isaac is the child of promise. But it's more than simply because God promised him, it is because God gave him. And this is what is true of every Christian. It is a miracle of God's grace in our lives by which we are born again. It is not just a flesh thing, a natural thing. It is by promise, according to spiritual realities. And Paul goes on to say then that it shouldn't surprise us that persecution should come to the sons of the free woman by the sons of the bondwoman. It is presented to us way back in Genesis chapter 21, he says. What does the scripture say? Just at that time, he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who was born according to the spirit. So also it is now. The followers of the law, the ones who try to relate to God according to the law, are persecutors of those who are born according to promise and who relate to God on the basis of his promises. The Galatians, you see, were being encouraged, were being commanded, were being urged, were being coerced to adopt a way of salvation that relied upon obedience to the law. And Abraham is saying, whose son do you want to be? Do you want to be Hagar's son? Or Sarah's son? Do you want to be the son of the bondwoman? Or do you want to be a son of the free woman? Do you want to be a son who receives nationhood? Or do you want to be the son who receives the covenant promises of God? This is the choice the Galatians must make. How are they going to approach God? On the basis of the law, I will keep his commands. On the basis of the promise, I will trust in the seed that was sent. Because you see, this is building on the unfolding promises of God of a Messiah, to whom Isaac himself pointed. Isaac's birth is not just a nice story of God's sovereignty. Isaac's birth pictures for us the promised coming of the Messiah. He was one who would come by a visitation of God, on the basis of the promises of God, at the time appointed by God. And he would come to bring joy to the earth. The same elements that are all focused there in the birth of Isaac come together in the birth of Jesus. by no accident or coincidence, but by the design of God. It is through Jesus Christ that the promise of the promised land comes, that the promise of true freedom and rest comes. Go again to the book of Hebrews and to the 11th chapter and see that even Abraham, with the limited understanding that he had, had his hope set not on Canaan and not on a city built there, but on heaven and upon the realities of this new Jerusalem. We need to trust in the promises of God and observe them as they have been fulfilled throughout Scripture, and the richness that we have of the unfolding revelation of God that leaves us with far less excuse for unbelief than Abraham had, or the Jews of Paul's day. For we have the full revelation. We have the explanations of the New Testament that interpret for us these episodes in the Old Testament. So let me leave you with a question to ponder. What kind of son are you? A son of promise? Believing in God? Or a son of bondage? Attempting to please God with your own words?